All right, Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. This week, we have basically editor Emil Stonick chatting with senior food editor Chris Morocco and associate editor Alex Delaney, and they are talking about one of the greatest things on earth, coffee, particularly everything you need to know about brewing and enjoying better coffee at home. And after that, we are airing one of the interviews we did back in November at our live podcast show. This one with Carla Lolly Music and Brad Leone talking about fermentation, how Brad delved into that world, and eventually how that fermented into his hit YouTube show, It's Alive. Sorry about that one. Anyways, let's do this thing. Here is Emil, Chris, and Delaney.
Hello, friends. Chris, Alex.
Hey, Emil.
How's it going, Emil?
Oh, you know, I'm doing all right. I'm like a little bit, to be honest, a little bit under-caffeinated right now, which is kind of a funny place to be in when you're hosting a podcast about coffee.
I've had 1.5 cups so far. I held back on the second so I could have another half cup later this afternoon.
Wow, you really are pretty like measured in your dosage.
I have to be. Otherwise, it just, I kind of go to a bad place,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like coffee, like the right amount of coffee is a great thing. Too much coffee, for me, terrible thing.
Oh, it's game over.
Yeah.
That's like, you know, I guess it's like anything else.
Yeah.
You know, that's just coffee. Colon. It's like anything else. Okay, so we are here today talking about coffee because in the February issue of the magazine, the Healthy-ish issue, we have a whole back of book section. I guess that's kind of inside baseball. Nobody calls it back of book, but that's for those of you out there who don't speak magazine speak, it's the last section in the magazine. That is the basically section of the magazine, and the theme for the whole section is coffee, making. Oh, my God. Whose phone is ringing?
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
Jeez.
It's okay. You're a dad. That's fine. It's fine.
No, sorry.
If you have kids, it's fine.
Yeah. So anyways, yeah, the section is about coffee and specifically how to make better coffee at home. And when we were thinking about putting this together and what kind of advice would be helpful for people, we were really trying to think about, you know, you don't have to be the like mustachioed third wave coffee shop type of person in order to make better coffee at home. There are just a few things that you can do that will make any cup of coffee that you make at home better. So starting with the beans. What's the deal with grinding coffee at home? Do I really have to? It's like I go to the supermarket, I'm looking at all the bags, I got all this ground coffee. Sometimes it's in giant tubs and it's very affordable. Can I buy that, or do I really need whole bean coffee?
All right. Well, I'm gonna ask Chris a question.
Okay. Yeah.
Chris, would you ever buy pre-ground black pepper?
Never.
Why?
Because the flavor kind of just flattens out the aroma, you know, it just loses its pungency. It just, and it kind of brings out some of the worst qualities in pepper, you know, without kind of retaining as many of the good ones. So you kind of get this sharp, kind of metallic, aggressive hit of kind of heat, but without like a whole lot of flavor to go with it.
Yeah, it's the exact same thing with coffee. Basically, the minute you grind a coffee bean, it starts leaking flavor. And if you buy beans that have been sitting on the shelf for weeks or months or years or whatever, they're going to be a fraction of what they could be.
So I guess what you're saying is like you have to think about a coffee bean as what it is, which is it's a fruit, right?
It's the seed of a fruit.
It's the seed, yeah.
So, and that seed of that fruit, if you grind it up, all of the kind of flavors and all of the oils and things like that that are inside of it, once it's ground, those start to kind of evaporate and disappear, and you're left with a cup of coffee that tastes a lot less.
Sure.
Way less.
If you've ever had a cup of coffee and it kind of makes you think it tastes like cardboard or some kind of old paper, like that's a symptom of pre-ground coffee.
So there's just nothing left.
Yeah. This is like continental breakfast.
You're tasting the roast, but you're not tasting the bean at that point at all. Yeah.
So yeah. Okay. So grinding your beans matters. I think we can agree that probably like regardless of what kind of beans you're buying, whole bean is better than pre-ground.
100%.
Absolutely.
And you know, we didn't talk about this in the magazine, but I'm curious, where do you guys fall on the little coffee pods? You just like throw them in the machine and press it down. And that's pre-ground coffee, right?
It is. I mean, obviously it's sealed in such a way in like a modified atmosphere. So it's, There's a time and a place, just like clamshells of salad greens, you know, with like baby arugula. I mean, there's a time and a place, yeah. Like less time and less places for me, just because I care about coffee so much. But in an office environment, or, you know, depending on what your setup is, like, can you train like Bob from accounts to like care about coffee if like that's just what he wants, you know, for his 11 o'clock? You know, maybe not.
Right. So just so we're clear, we're not shaming anybody.
No. No. And what you like, I mean, just to get this out of the way, I mean, what you like is what you like, and you should never let anybody tell you that like your choices are wrong. If, you know, you want just like really dark roasted beans, like go for it. You do you.
Yeah, we're not going to yuck your yum, but yeah. I will make a comment on the pods. They're terrible for the environment.
That's true. That's
so bad.
That's true.
And if you can make a cup of coffee without, you know, killing some trees.
Right.
It's fine by me.
Well, yeah. You know, and I'm going to say, if I'm sitting in the Jiffy Lube, like waiting for my oil change, I would rather probably see one of those like instant one pod, one cup sort of situations than a pot of coffee that's been simmering on like a burner with a burner underneath it for like God knows how long. It's kind of sludgy.
Yes.
Yep.
Yep.
But time and a place, time and a place. Okay. So whole beans, that's the move. That means you're probably going to need a grinder.
Yes, absolutely. 100%.
And what, I mean, like, but what's the deal with grinders?
You have blade grinders, like your $20 Krups or Cuisinart grinder, or you step up to a burr grinder where you have...
So just to work, the blade grinder that you're talking about, that's the one where it's kind of like 6 inches tall and it's got like a removable top. You put the beans in, you put the top back on, you press the button, and it's like... Bzz, 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 bzz.
And I truly will stand, you know, behind this 100%. If there's one thing you can do to up your coffee game, grinding your own, even with that $20 Krups grinder, it'll be the best money you ever spend. Because people, you know, will certainly nerd out on, oh, but a burr grinder, you know, where you have these rotating conical burrs, kind of more like a pepper mill, if you will, you know, kind of grinding things into kind of uniform shape after like multiple passes around like the grinding cones. A blade grinder, it's kind of chopping your beans and it's not doing it, you know, to as specific and uniform a size, but it will transform your coffee.
And there are some things that you can do when you're using a burr grinder, right, to get a little bit, because the problem is that the blades are just where the blades are and the beans are where the beans are. And that means you're going to get powder on the bottom and then kind of like more chunky stuff up top.
Yeah.
But you can, I mean, when I was at a time where I was still unconvinced as to the burr grinder, you know, like whether or not I was really going to spend money on a burr grinder, which, you know, it's not a lot of money. You know, you're going to spend between like $100 and $150 probably on one, but it's still an investment, a good investment, I would say. But with my little blade grinder, I would shake it.
Mm-hmm.
I would buzz a little bit, I'd shake it, I'd buzz a little bit again, shake it, buzz a little bit again. That way, just to get those, you know, the pieces circulating a little bit.
Absolutely. That's a good trick.
Yeah. And the other thing that people talk about with a burr grinder is that it doesn't heat the beans. And this is, again, this might be a little nerdy, but if you're going to grind your own coffee beans, you want the first time that they're subjected to heat to be whenever they touch the hot water, not when they touch a blade or a motor that's kind of heating up and that's going to like mess with the oils, mess with the flavor, mess with the freshness. So that's why in the test kitchen, we use a burr grinder.
Right, because you can dial in the setting, you know, such that you know, like, roughly, like, what size the grounds are going to come out as. With a blade grinder, you're kind of guesstimating. You're looking, you're kind of tamping that top down, peeking, you know, kind of saying, oh, is this a little finer than yesterday? Well, you know, who cares? It's 7 a.m. We got to get going here, you
right,
know?
Right, right. Well, and so this is a little bit 2.0, but also what you're describing is that, you know, you need different, like a different consistency to the grind depending on how you're going to brew it, right? Like if you're using a French press, because you're just kind of soaking the beans in the hot water, you want a coarser grind. But if you're making on the opposite side espresso, you want it really, really fine, like almost like confectioner sugar fine.
Yes, yeah. Like immersion methods absolutely are going to require a coarser grind because otherwise you can over-extract, you know, basically the solids from the bean and basically turn it bitter.
Yeah, yeah. The basic rule there is that like the finer the coffee ground, the more you're going to extract from the coffee because there's more surface area for the water to touch. So if you're the kind of person, say you're just looking at a pour over, if you want more from the beans.
So hold on, back up just a second. Yeah. A pour over, what are we talking about when we're saying a pour over? Because I feel like people have seen this, but I don't, it seems like.
Yeah. So, you know, like when you walk into a coffee shop and you see one person that's waiting in front of the counter and they're waiting in front of the counter for like 7 minutes and you're like, why is this person waiting so long for a cup of coffee? It's probably because they ordered a pour over. It's basically a simple version of a drip coffee machine. It's one serving of coffee that's one serving of coffee beans that's ground, put in a filter, and then poured a little bit of water is poured over it for a specific amount of time.
And that filter is sitting inside a cone.
It's sitting inside a cone.
Over top of the vessel that you're dripping
yeah,
into.
Yeah, so it's dripping directly down into some kind of pouring vessel, or could even be like the thing you're drinking out of.
Right. So in that case, you're just pouring the hot water over them. They're kind of like getting saturated, and you're extracting some of the goodness from the coffee, and then it's dripping pretty much immediately out into the cup.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Gotcha. Okay. Well, let's back up a little bit. So we got the whole beans.
Yes.
We're buying whole beans. We got our own grinder, whether that's like a little blade grinder, which, you know, you can find those at like any thrift shop, like, you know, they're kind of everywhere. And it's like worth having one of those, even if you graduate to the burr grinder, because then you can use that for spices. That's a different story.
Yeah. Yes.
But what kind of beans should I be buying? Like, what am I looking for? Like, do I have to go to like the fancy third wave coffee shop? What am I looking for if I'm just like, I'm at the grocery store, I'm at the like bodega, I'm at the market? What am I looking for on that packaging that's going to tell me that this is good coffee?
Bird's eye view of like coffee and like the bags of coffee, like, you know, and this is like maybe getting a little bit 2.0. So you just feel free to shut me down if you need to, Emil. But like, there's bags of coffee that have expiration dates on them.
Mm-hmm.
And there are bags of coffee that have roasting dates on them.
Interesting.
So
those are different things.
Those are very different things. So if you find a kind of a bag of coffee and it says roasted on, and it seems to have taken, the roasting date was about, you know, a week or so in the past, there's a pretty solid chance that it's been roasted by somebody who cares. Maybe somewhat locally, maybe not, you know, but or from like a national kind of like specialty coffee company. And you have a reasonable chance of getting something that, you know, is just a little bit more kind of cared for and looked after. And, you know, maybe if you're really into coffee, it'll give you a little bit more of what you want. Whereas a lot of other kind of bagged coffees that are sold at grocery stores, what you find on them is expiration dates, because they've been roasted at some point. They've been bagged and they've been kind of, you know, a little bit more engineered to be a little bit more shelf stable, if you will. But really, they are never going to have the aromas and flavors, you know, that people like Alex and me love to geek out on at 3 o'clock, you know, in the afternoon. But that's not to say that like it's bad coffee or that you shouldn't buy it. It just usually tends to be, coffees usually tend to fall into one of those two categories.
Right. Well, it seems like that's, you know, it seems like it's about transparency, right? Which is the case for plenty of other, you know, things that you buy, you know, food things that you buy. The difference between saying, we roasted this here at this time, and, you know, you want to enjoy a cup of, you know, you want to enjoy beans, what, like around 2 weeks is like kind of the range?
A week from to 2 weeks, yeah.
Yeah, and that's like for the premium experience. Somebody's telling you that, they're saying like, if you know, maybe you don't want to buy this after 2 weeks. Maybe that's not going to be ideal. But the expiration date, on the other hand, is like, this is like the last possible time that you should be drinking this coffee, which could be like a year from the time that it's roasted, which is like a little more sketch.
And how it tastes on month one is going to be very much how it tastes on month three, assuming you haven't opened the bag.
Right.
And that's like, you know, true of like a lot of Starbucks coffee and stuff. They're not putting roasting dates on most of their coffees, as, you know, and neither do like a lot of like nationally distributed coffee companies.
Yeah. And the thing with transparency in coffee is that if you don't know what's going on, it's probably because the coffee roaster doesn't want you to know what's going on.
Mm.
So it's basically about having the most information you can about the coffee that you're buying. So you want to know, where was it roasted? When was it roasted? Not when is it going to go bad? And where did the beans come from? And that's the whole location of beans. Like, Chris and I have so many theories, and we think we know what beans taste like from certain countries, but in reality, it's like wine, right? You can have a Chardonnay that tastes like one thing and a Chardonnay that tastes like another thing. You can have a Kenyan bean that tastes like one thing and a Kenyan bean that tastes like another thing. But just knowing that the coffee roasters care about where the beans are coming from, even down to the specific plot of land, the farm, the farmer that grows it. That's just showing you that they care a little bit more about their coffee, and it's probably going to taste better.
Gotcha. If that information is something that they can be proud of, they're going to put it
right
on the bag.
100%.
You're going to see, like, information. I think it's great that Alex brought up wine. You're going to see information, like, in the vein of, like, what you'd find on a wine label, mm-hmm. where it was grown, even, like, an elevation, the producer, you know, how it was harvested, you know, percentages of varietals that went into it. You know, you can go very deep.
Right. So if I'm not trying to go that deep, if I'm not trying to, like, get the, like, specific, like, latitude and longitude for this, like, plot of land where these beans were growing and what the farmers' names were and all of that, I feel like most people, the big question is the roast, right? Light roast,
dark
roast. And that's, like, to me, I used to go to this coffee shop in Massachusetts, and they would always have it was a nice third wave shop, and they would always have a light roast drip and a dark roast drip. And they would always, you know, if people came up and they're like, oh, which one should I don't know, which one should I have? They're like, do you like Dunkin' Donuts or do you like Starbucks? And somebody would be like, oh, I like Dunkin' Donuts. They're like, you want the light roast.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, I like Starbucks. You get the dark roast. Which is, you know, I think most people, actually how light roasted coffee and dark roasted coffee taste is kind of like an abstraction. So how would you describe that to somebody?
Go ahead, Alex.
Those of you who are listening at home, you cannot quite appreciate, like, these two coffee nerds, like, looking at each other and just both being like, ooh, I have things to say.
That is how I feel right now, actually. If I had to put it in a single sentence, light roast is the coffee with complexity and dark roast is the coffee with robustness, right?
So yeah, power, strength.
Power. So ooh. Basically, yeah, we're getting ideological here. If you look at light roast coffee, there's going to be a lot more to unpack. It's going to be, and this is a blanket statement, it doesn't refer to every single light roast coffee that's ever been roasted. But if you're looking at light roast coffee, there's going to be more fruity flavors, there's going to be lighter flavors, there's going to be more acid, not chemically more acid, but when we say acid,
it's
we mean
taste
brighter.
Brighter, yeah.
It's going to drink more like a tea, not exactly like tea, but more like a tea than dark roast coffee does. And then if you look at dark roast coffee, all of those flavors that kind of come out during the roasting, the subjection to heat, they're going to simplify. The longer they're in contact with heat, kind of the tighter and the tighter and the tighter they get and the darker they get. So you're going to get more flavors like graham crackers and dark chocolate and biscuits and roasted nuts, stuff like that. But the thing about the dark roasted coffee too is that as those oils in the beans start to develop, right, they rise to the surface of the coffee, and it actually, there's some kind of evaporation that happens. So the beans are actually less dense. You would think dark roasted, more dense, more going on. They're actually less dense, so there's less oil in the beans. The oil rises to the surface, and it actually gives the body of the coffee, so what it feels like when it's in your mouth, right, it gives it a richer body because there's more oils on the surface of the bean. And the oil kind of, like when you talk about emulsifying a salad dressing, right, it gives the liquid some kind of like thicker, chunkier texture.
Interesting. So there's, and you know, I mean, it also seems like there's light roast, there's dark roast, there's everything in the middle. You know, I feel like for most people, something in kind of like the medium range is like what really like pings in their brain as coffee. I feel like I know a lot of people who, you know, the first time they have a really light roasted coffee, which was, you know, kind of in vogue for a long time. I mean, you know, it still is, but I feel like aggressively light roasted coffee. People are like, this tastes crazy. This tastes like herbal tea. It's like really acidic, and like, you know, when it's not done that well, it can sometimes be unpleasant to drink. Yeah. And likewise, dark roasted coffee, when you've got those like oily, like burnt beans, that's like, I tend to think if the beans look oily, it's a little too dark.
Yeah,
it certainly can be. Yeah.
Yeah,
you usually don't find oily beans like, you know, in like a lot of specialty roasting companies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, I feel like there's that like sweet spot in the middle where you're like, this tastes like coffee.
Yeah,
coffee tasting coffee.
Mm-hmm.
the whole roasting, light roast versus dark roast, this is kind of like a matter of preference and is like, you know, to me feels like a range to explore. I mean, again, no shade on somebody who's just like, I like what I like. I'm going to drink that every morning. I'm going to drink that every afternoon. But, you know, I do think that there's something valuable about like bringing home a bag of light roasted coffee, bringing home something a little darker, tasting them, you know, one morning and one the other, and really just getting to a kind of, you know, that's how you find where your range is yeah. and what you like.
Yeah, and absolutely. It's like if someone's like, you know, I'm a light roasted coffee person because they've only ever drank light roasted coffee, it's like, how do you know?
Yep. Yeah.
You gotta test out the other side of the spectrum.
Yeah, and it's nice to have the information on the bag to be able to, you know, retain that kind of information of, oh, I really like this coffee and why, you know, where did it come from? If it was a blend, you know, do I know anything about what, you know, the constituent parts of the blend might be?
Yeah. Okay. So at this point, we have left the store. We have our coffee.
Yeah, we did.
Be it light roasted, be it dark roasted.
But it's whole bean.
It's whole bean. And ideally, it's got a roast date on it. And ideally, that roast date was, you know, within 2 weeks of when you're planning to enjoy it. We're there. We are home.
Yes.
We are going to make coffee. Now, this is a thing that I feel like really, like, resonates with, like, the college student in me. Like, how much coffee are we using when we're making coffee? Because I remember I used to have a roommate who would just like, we'd get like a big tub of Maxwell House and we'd have our like automatic drip Mr. Coffee sort of thing. And he would just like sling coffee in there. And it was just like, he's like, oh, I like it. I like it really dark. I like my coffee really strong. And you're like, is there really a range to like how much coffee you're adding? Is there some kind of golden ratio? Like how much coffee are we using? We've ground it also. We've ground our coffee.
Okay. We've ground our coffee. Cool. Yes.
I mean, basically, you know, what most people look at as a ratio is 1 to 16 in terms of ground coffee by weight to water by weight. So we're looking basically at putting 2 to 3 tablespoons of ground coffee in for a 12-ounce cup of coffee that you're going to make like as a pour over, for example.
Okay.
And yes, totally. But what Chris said before that, I think, is actually really important when you think about coffee. And, you know, in the test kitchen, people talk about this with baking, too, measuring by weight. Mm. Remember when we were talking about how you can adjust the settings on a burr grinder if you want to have a finer grind or a coarser grind? A tablespoon of coarse grind coffee is going to be much less coffee because it's not as compact than a tablespoon of finely ground coffee.
Right.
So if you really want to get to that 16-to-1 ratio, do it by weight.
Gotcha. Okay, so that's the next level. That's like probably like once you've got the burr grinder, once you've got the, then you're like grinding it and then weighing it out. Yeah. And then,
well, I think the thing to go with that though is like you don't necessarily have to do that every time. Like, yes, they're doing that every time at Blue Bottle and like other coffee shops, you know, where you are paying $4 or $5 for every cup of coffee. Yeah. But at home, you know, I think if you have like your lucky magic coffee scooping spoon, you know, as like many of us do, it's kind of like, oh yeah, it's about 1.5 of these with like the water up to here in the mug that my grandma gave me, you know, 8 years ago, you know?
Totally.
And like, and then like, yeah, you don't, I'm not weighing anything in the morning. Are you kidding? You know?
Right.
But like young people like bellowing for toast, like, you know, like making demands, trying to make like Amber her tea, you know, and like not like freak out. So yeah, I'm not weighing anything in the morning at all. But at a certain point along the way, I sort of stopped and like did a little check-in about, okay, what are my rough like, you know, volumetric measurements that kind of convert to this sort of golden rule?
Totally. Yeah, I definitely like am not weighing things. I'm not breaking the scale out at like 7:30 in the morning. That's just not happening.
Yeah.
But you know, I do know I've got I like brew with a pour over. I've been using the same like plastic pour over cone for like 10 years. I put it on a quart size mason jar. I've got my like burr grinder and it's got a little dial for like the, you know, we're making like 4 cups of coffee. So I like dial it up to 4 and then that's, you know, that works for me. You know, I feel like it is how, you know, how granular you want to get, how nerdy you want to get. But at the end of the day, it is also about your taste and your preference and finding something that works for you. But adding more, but I guess the real question is adding more coffee make better coffee?
No.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, it's hard to describe, but you'll bring out too often like too many of like the bitter kind of like sort of like undesirable traits in a coffee if you have too much that you've extracted into like too small a volume of water, you know. And I think, you know, adding sugar and milk, you know, like I put milk in my coffee, that has a balancing effect, you know, where like, yeah, I can brew a much stronger coffee in theory, you know, than like the, you know, the measurements we just described. I can put milk in it and it kind of rebalances it. So, you know, how you're treating coffee on the back end does have like mitigating effects, you know, whatever you've done, you know, at seven o'clock in the morning.
Totally. That's a really good point. And I feel like, you know, how you take your coffee, like I'm a black coffee drinker. And so like, I like drinking some of the lighter roasted, like more acidic coffees black, but I feel like I've also heard complaints from people who are the cream and sugar people. They put that into their light roasted coffee and then all of a sudden it's like
really thin.
Yeah. Really thin and watery. It does taste like tea.
Yeah.
But to me, like a really, really dark roasted coffee black is like a little more than I can handle in the morning.
Yeah.
I think the thing to think about when you talk about someone who's like dumping coffee into the coffee machine and being like, I like strong coffee. At that point, it doesn't matter how much coffee you've put in the machine. You've already made your choice with the beans that you bought, right? Mm-hmm. Like the decision of, oh, I'm going to have light or strong coffee doesn't happen when you really make the coffee.
Gotcha.
It happens when you buy the beans. So if you bought light roasted beans and you're using that 16-to-1 ratio, it's going to be a different flavor than, you know, dark roasted beans and you're using the 16-to-1 ratio. So it doesn't really, I mean, it does matter how much you put into your, you know, AeroPress or your pour over or your drip coffee machine, but in actuality it really matters more which beans you ended up buying in the first place.
Gotcha.
Yeah, because frankly, like certain beans only have so much to give.
Yeah,
right.
And so at a certain point you're kind of wasting coffee if you're just dumping more and more and more coffee. You can only extract so much flavor, you can only get so much caffeine, you're kind of limited by like the physics of the situation.
Totally.
Yeah.
Okay, so you said a word. You said AeroPress. And we've also mentioned pour over.
Yes.
So we're talking about methods of brewing coffee. So I've ground it. I've eyeballed it. Maybe I've like measured out. I put on my safety glasses and like measured out, you know, 16-to-1 ratio of beans to coffee. How are we brewing it? Because I feel like there's like a lot of like there are kind of two like paths. There's like the high tech where you have like an escalating like price situation. Like you can get sold on all the bells and whistles of some automatic machine, some of which are really good, some of which are kind of meh, a case of diminishing returns. And then you have the kind of like low tech, low investment methods. Where are you guys and what are some of your favorite ways of making coffee?
I think that's actually one of the biggest myths about coffee is that you need to invest a lot of money in whatever machine you're using to brew your coffee to get good coffee. Mm-hmm. Chris and I, most days in the test kitchen, we use our little plastic pour-over cone into a glass carafe and
that's what I do at home, too. I don't have a coffee maker at home.
Yeah.
I have a grinder, but I don't have a coffee maker.
Yeah.
I just have, my filter and cone set up, and it's fantastic. Yeah. It's not about investing in equipment necessarily.
Right,
know.
For sure. And I think the other thing you have to ask yourself when you're picking, you know, I think Chris and I both like a pour over the best for making a cup of coffee. But when we make a cup of coffee in the afternoon, we usually do it around 3 o'clock. We're splitting a cup of coffee. You know, at that point, we've already been caffeinated for the day. We just need that little extra boost to like get us through the day. But if you're making coffee for more than just one or two people, like I would use a French press if you're gonna keep to the cheap coffee making methods. It's it's also about how much coffee you want to make.
Gotcha. So the pour over is like kind of the ultimate low tech. It's like, you know, a cone, you put a filter in it, you get it wet, you put the coffee in, you pour the hot water into it until it fills up your cup, and then you've got coffee.
Yeah.
So then we've got the French press, which I feel like people are familiar with. You know, that's the one where you're like, you're putting the coffee grounds in, you're filling it up with water, you put the little hat on it, and you plunge the plunger down so that you filter out all of the grounds. and get your coffee. What is an AeroPress? What does that mean?
AeroPress is a great little, you know, kind of bit of coffee brewing equipment. I want to say, what does it cost? Like $30 maybe? It's kind of a cylindrical kind of device with a plunger on one end where you can kind of put the grounds in one end and put then sort of put the water in on top of them. And then you have this, just this tiny little filter. Like you, when you buy one, like you get like 200 filters or something for like very inexpensively. You sort of screw a sort of a mesh cap with a filter on the underside of it to that cylinder, and then you invert it and plunge the coffee down. It sounds a little bit more complicated hearing myself describe it than it really is. It's like, it's actually quite a simple bit.
You did a good job
it's
of
like
describing
kind of
it,
like
though.
Imagine like a syringe, but like you're putting where the needle would go, like you're putting coffee and water in, and then you just, you know, you basically put a top on and flip it upside down and plunge it into.
You're not injecting it into
and
your
you
body.
And you are not putting it into your bloodstream.
Mainlining
at
coffee.
Least not directly. And it's great. I mean, it doesn't make very much coffee. It makes like maybe 7 ounces. I use it primarily when I'm traveling because it is a very compact little bit of kit that travels really well. And the filters, you don't have to worry about kind of getting them all crumply or whatever.
So you take that if you're like, you know, I'm going to be staying in this place. I don't know what their coffee setup is like. I know I'm going to want my cup of coffee. It's
Absolutely.
Just me. You're going to pack your AeroPress, which weighs like nothing.
Nothing.
You know?
Yeah.
And a little bit of, you know, some coffee. Do you are you into the portable grinder?
Oh yeah, I have couple of hand grinders. Well, because you know I got my whole beans as Alex instructed me to, and I can't lug around, you know, a 30-pound like coffee grinder, you know, on vacation. So a hand grinder does the job. I mean, look, if you're trying to make coffee for 4 people, you will hate yourself. Please, in that case, just run your bag of beans through, you know, your coffee grinder before you leave for the week, and you know what, like it'll be fine.
Right. You're doing what you can.
Yeah, you're doing the best you can with it. Reason. Right. But that AeroPress is great because it's an immersion method, you know, where by which we mean, you know, putting grounds directly into water, you know, not just pouring water through it. So you get a very full, very rich extraction. And I even like, I'll make it kind of extra strong in the AeroPress and then just thin it out with a little bit of water just so I have enough volume, you know,
gotcha.
Kind of.
So kind of like making like an Americano once you've got pulled an espresso shot.
People kind of like, I don't know, people talk about AeroPress as though it's like, can potentially make a shot of espresso as though it's extracting under pressure, which is not the case.
No.
I mean, it can make very strong, you know, perfectly fine coffee, you know, if you want it to, but it's not like an espresso method where you literally are, you know, you are increasing like the atmospheres inside, you know, the machine to extract under pressure.
Okay. And the fact talking about atmospheres now, I think is my cue to wrap things up in the beginner's guide
very
to
well
brewing
behaved.
Coffee.
I'm literally sitting here with a coffee flavor wheel just in case. I wasn't going to bring it up. Okay, but it's just in case, all right? I've got savory, spice, grain and cereal, nut, sweetened, sugary, chocolate, dried fruit, berry, stone fruit, tropical fruit. Anyway,
guys,
I'll be fine.
Thank you so much. Let's go drink a cup of coffee.
All right, sounds good.
I'm down.
All right, thanks to Emil, Chris, and Alex. And now, here is Carla and Brad.
So, Brad, I was thinking about this today because I was thinking, well, how do you kick it off with Brad Leone, who everyone knows, and, like, obviously, we know each other really well. And then I was like, we really do know each other pretty well because I think right now in the test kitchen, you and I are the veterans.
We're the only ones left. Well, Morocco doesn't count anymore.
He doesn't count because he came and he went away and then he came back. But I started in August 2011.
That's right.
And you were the same month. I feel like we were almost the same month.
Pretty close, yeah. I took a job as a dishwasher.
In the TK. This was at Four Times Square.
Yeah.
So this is going back. I didn't have my job. I was an editor.
Everything was different.
Everything was different. But I feel like even back then, like I knew a few things about you. I knew that you loved slicing deli meat even then.
Oh yeah, it was my first job. I grew up Mike's on the Corner in Fairfield, New Jersey. That's what I did. I mean, all day. It was just running a deli slicer. And I love it. I love a deli slicer, you know. You know, there's something to be said about a thinly sliced meat. You know?
Yeah. there really is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as you can see in our ham sandwiches that we made today.
Other people could have sliced the ham, but when we were planning it, it was like, obviously, Brad's going to do the ham.
No, I can't take that risk. You know, all of a sudden, it's a little too thick or right. something happens. I like to do things myself.
You know? Yeah. So there was that. I knew that about you. I knew the deli. I knew that you were from Jersey.
Yeah, North Jersey.
Right, North Jersey.
Northern Jersey, okay.
And I think I even knew that that your lady and my cat had the same name.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, Peggy is the name. Yeah.
That's right.
She's not here today, but she's taking care of our lovely children.
My Peggy's not here either. but I don't think I knew, and I don't know when I knew, that you loved fermentation.
Well, it kind of happened organically, you know, no pun intended. No, like, so like, you know, as you know, I took the job doing, you know, as a kitchen assistant and was helping out, and we were doing cross-testing and recipe development a little, and I was also doing a lot of all of the shopping and the dishwashing and stuff. And then, you know, once that started to grow a little bit, and by the time we moved out to the World Trade Center, you know, I was doing all the sourcing, and we have a great walk-in, and we're always doing different recipes and stuff, and a byproduct of that is that sometimes there are leftovers.
Right.
You know, so we started fooling around with just fermenting a little bit, and it all really started with a friend who gifted me a SCOBY for a symbiotic community of bacteria and yeast.
That's a real friend right there. Yeah. Someone who, like, gives so you their SCOBY.
A lady, she's like, hey, you got to try this, blah, 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 and I was like, whoa. And so we started making kombucha, and like really that was the first episode of It's Alive, and that's really kind of how it all started.
Yeah, when I look back on it now, it really was the kombucha that I remember you doing the most, and then obviously it was the first video.
And it was kind of just like a little project on the side.
Right.
You know, it was like in between the jobs, we had some little downtime or whatever. You can go tinker around. You know, I like my projects,
right.
You know.
And now we have a whole area of the kitchen, fermentation.
Small little nook.
Yeah, it's got a nook, but there's a lot of SCOBYs over there now.
Oh yeah.
And you said today you had to feed the ladies today.
Oh, feed the girls today. I actually did that today. Yeah, nice little tea solution, and you know, it was the first episode of It's Alive, but also look, it's my least favorite looking back. Like I like it in a way, but it was so sloppy.
Right.
And you know, my kombucha production process now, I mean, I don't want to say sophisticated, but it's come a long way. We're not siphoning by mouth anymore.
You would do things differently. Yeah. I have the same thing, and in fact, when that video was being edited, and it was being this was like way back in the day when I would look at the food videos before they were published, and I remember there's that part where it overflows and it's the thing, and I was like, this isn't good.
No, this is a mess. Yeah.
I was like, we don't want to keep, and it was, and I was the only one who thought, and I was like, no, it's great, it's great. And I think that it is what feels fun and real.
Well, yeah.
And that carries through. But I was like, no one needs to see.
What is this mess? This guy is an idiot.
Yeah.
No, but you know, I think it really dials it back into the human element of it.
Right.
Where we're all trying, you know, people like cooking, and we all like cooking, and it's not a clean studio. We make mistakes, things happen, the hose falls off, things spill on the ground. And that's what happens when people take these recipes. I mean, not that this was a recipe, but you know, when you're cooking at home, things happen. You
oh,
know?
Yeah.
And like even like in the test kitchen, like things happen. And like for a long time we were always shooting hands and pans and overhead, and it was very clean.
Right.
And it was very curated in a way. And then like, you know, we started, as videos started to take off, they're like, all right, Brad's got something. We don't know what it is yet. you know, that clean video, that's not gonna work. Like
right.
That like he sucks there. So like just it was actually on it comes I think it came down to like Grossman. It was a gentleman who was the art director.
Now works at Apple.
No one knows what he does. Yeah.
But that's how it is.
I think
when
he was like, just, you know, just go follow Brad around.
Right.
Just go like, just he's doing something. It's a lot of fun. Like people like hanging out with him. Just like, just follow him. And that's where Vinny came in.
Right.
And that's where Vince just started.
Vinny.
Well, don't clap yet. He didn't join us tonight because he had other things to do.
Oh, he's not with us tonight?
But, no, he's not with us tonight. But Matt Hunziker is, you know, it's a three-part band, and, you know, Matt Hunziker, he's over here somewhere, and he does a lot of the editing as well. It's not, most of it, it's not
I think Vinny not being here sort of keeps in line with his Snuffleupagus kind of, you know, persona. Yeah. Like, everybody talks about him, but you never really see him.
It's all in my head.
Yeah. But so going back to that kombucha and the experimentation part of it, because I think that's also at the heart of the projects.
Yeah.
Like, did you have a recipe? Or so this lady gives you a SCOBY and you're like, I know what this is for. Like,
Allie
how
Marnie.
Did you make your what was the first batch?
It was good. So it was like, she gave me these things and she's like, oh, you got to feed them and then taste it. And like, literally every time you do it, you learn.
Right.
And like, I love that. You never really stop learning. And not only, that's not just fermentation, that's cooking, I think. And I got the SCOBY and she gave me a base recipe, which was 70 grams of sugar and 7 grams of tea. And you need the black tea for its tannins or whatever. And then you just feed it, and you times whatever. And I did a small batch, but then I'm like, well, this is a lot of work. Like, if we're going to do it, we should try to up the production a little. And it started coming out much better than the stuff we were buying and consuming normally.
Yeah.
And then we just started drinking it amongst the kitchen.
Yeah.
And that was like, 3 years ago.
Yeah, still drinking it, still here.
Yeah, it's good. And every time it's a little different. I stopped labeling it, I don't know what flavor it is anymore. But.
Right.
but it's there.
There's a piece of tape on all of them and like a date.
Yeah, and that's probably old. It's probably not even the actual batch. Yeah.
And then from kombucha, so I have a little list of some of the things, but one of my favorite things that you do that also is one of the things that you really believe in that sometimes you have to convince the rest of us is some of the garlic products.
Yeah. Well, everyone's scared of botulism, and and it's real, but it's actually harder to it's harder to get sick from botulism than you think.
Right.
I mean, the easiest way to do it is put garlic in olive oil. I mean, that's a big no-no. But for the most part, as long as it's not in a complete anaerobic environment, don't worry about it.
So when people get the sniffles, right, sometimes you'll just say, eat a raw garlic. Like,
you don't just go eating a raw garlic. You got to crush it first, and you got to let that Allison.
Oh, the Allison.
The Allison's where it's at. And, that's when you crush it, and it's a little two-part thing, and it happens, and it makes a compound. So what we really think, I've said this like a trillion times.
Can't you crush it with your teeth?
No, time. So it thinks that something's eating it, and it's like when the cell walls rupture, they mix and they make a new chemical called allicin, and it's really a defense mechanism for the garlic.
But you do eat raw cloves of garlic.
Oh, yeah, every
And
week.
You're pushing it on other people
and
on your wife, all kinds of things.
I work for the garlic board.
But the one that I really liked was the garlic in the honey, which I think we've got a jar coming up on 2 years.
Yeah, Andy stole my recipe. It's fine.
Yeah. For the garlic primer, you mean?
Yeah. No, it's cool. and that's a super simple thing. And it's so you just take raw garlic. I like to lightly bruise it, crush it up a little, get that Allison going. And then you just put it in a nice raw honey, and it kind of loosens it. And off the bat, a lot of people message me. They're like, oh, my garlic's floating. And the biggest problem with that, it's not a problem, but it's the gas from fermentation. So it makes like a little bit, it gives it a buoyancy and it floats. But once the gas is released completely, it sinks again. And it gets like, it's amazing. And the garlic just stays chewy and pliable and it loses that aggressive bite.
Yeah.
And then the garlic, the honey itself becomes gives that garlic aroma. And it's great in a braise or a vinaigrette or on pizza or something.
I mean, I should have had some today. I got a little cold.
Raw garlic,
I know.
Man. Always.
I don't know what I was thinking.
I don't want to smell. I don't want to, you pick your problem,
So wait, you mentioned people are sending you messages about what's happening. So for them when they're doing these things. So when you started the series, did it even occur to you that people were going to try to do these things?
I would hope so.
Oh, really?
Well, I mean, I didn't want to just, it's not just like a demo. I want people to do it.
But the way that you're going, at least, especially in some of the early ones, right? It's not like recipe. Yeah. And even doing fermentation recipes in the magazine, which we tried to do, the research department, they just about lose their minds.
Oh, they throw up. Yeah.
They can't handle it. Well, they're like sending us stuff from the FDA, and we're like, oh my God, and the amount of salt and the
FDA.
It's just like.
They hate fermentation, man. Let me tell you what. Me and the FDA, we don't really see eye to eye on most things.
So you're doing it now, and people are like, you know what? I'm getting myself a SCOBY.
Yeah.
I'm getting some garlic.
Yeah.
I'm getting my kraut.
Yeah,
I'm making some dill pickles.
A little kimchi, maybe make some miso.
Right.
There you go, huh?
And then how much troubleshooting are people, like, I get a lot of people taking pictures of the food from the videos, from the recipes in the magazine, from the stuff we talk about on the podcast, whatever. Send me pictures and I try to look at them. So can you talk a little bit about some of the photos that people have sent you?
Yeah. So, I mean, mostly it's like their projects, you know. It's like people are just stoked that hey, this worked, you know. A lot of them, they don't work. And it's a lot of them are failures and, like, things blow up or something like that. But, like, I've been there, you know, and that's... I'm just glad people are trying and breaking out of their mold and trying something a little different.
Out of the mold. Yeah. Ah, get it?
Yeah. I get it now. And, and you know, and just trying things. You know, it's not a new thing. It's been around for forever. And I'm glad to see it and be a part of helping it come back. And, I mean, fermentation's so broad. I mean, a lot of people don't think of it, but a lot of the flavors and ingredients and things that people love in, you know, their Thai restaurant or this or that, it usually comes from some form of fermentation. Kind of like when we made that chocolate episode.
Right.
You know, a lot of people, and I didn't even, you know, a couple of years ago, I didn't even know that chocolate is fermented.
Right.
Before there's a process of fermentation. So it's just really interesting to see how it kind of relates to a big picture.
Right. And who are some of the people that you know, people are looking to you and like, okay, Brad's doing this. I can do this thing. Where do you go for who are some of your fermenting heroes?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. I pull from a lot. I pull a lot of inspiration from folks who aren't really focused solely on fermentation. I mean, right. I've always been a big fan. When I took the job as a glorified dishwasher many years ago, my first like chef that was like a star that I really loved, who I got an honor to meet recently, was Rene Redzepi. And I just loved how passionate and enthusiastic he still is. Even though, you know, he got all these crazy awards and this famous restaurant, he was still like super passionate about his ingredients. And then when they started diving into their fermentation and they have that new book out with David, I mean, they're going a little deeper, much, much deeper than I.
Right.
So I mean, I guess I would tip a hat to them, Sandor Katz. But a lot of it just kind of came from me just kind of, I don't know, just taking interest in certain things. I don't know. Yeah.
There's always that moment in Gourmet Makes and Claire's in Claire's videos. Well, she'll go over to like the computer and like start looking stuff up. And I can't remember if it was in the butter video or one of them. There were some of those moments with you and Claire, just like going on the internet and looking for base recipes.
I mean, I'm not gonna lie, the internet's a fantastic tool. I mean. I mean, before there was that, it was just books and like, you know, which is great. I mean, I still hit the book sometimes,
right.
But I mean, let's not lie. Half of you are looking at your phone right now. there's a lot of information that you can get really quick. And
Right. Even
though we spend a lot of our time doing stupid stuff on the internet, it is actually a very, very useful tool. And I'm grateful for that.
I like the idea of sort of starting with five or six different recipes. And I do the same thing when I'm working on development or trying to come up with something where you'll go and sort of look at five or six different recipes and find that through line and then figure out, okay, it seems like this and this are the constants, and then the other stuff you improvise. So in times that you have improvised, can you talk about some of the failures?
Yeah.
Some of the things that didn't make it.
Remind me of the failures, because it's kind of like cooking for me.
Well, there was an explosion.
Oh no! I mean, I was gonna drift. Bring me back to the failures.
Oh.
So like.
Oh. Okay.
So like fermentation is kind of like cooking, where it's like, you know, you're constantly learning.
Right.
But some of the failures, you know, the one that sticks out was I was working a while back. I love Lambrusco. You know, it's like a low ABV carbonated red wine. I'm just a big fan. And when it's good.
Yeah.
And I wanted to make one in the kitchen, you know. So I had some grapes, I had some yeast, a little bit of sugar, I fermented it, and we bottled it, and I was like, oh, you know, I think it's good. And then we bottled it, and Chris Morocco was standing by me. Chris, let me build up the climax here, all right?
Okay, so but for the record, Chris Morocco is someone who keeps... He's fine. He also does have a pair of safety glasses at his station that he doesn't not use.
No, he uses all the time. And he's safety first, always. But not today. And not that day. So we made this Lambrusco, and we bottled it. Well, I bottled it. And, you know, it was at room temperature. And this was a while back. I learned a bunch. And it was room temperature. So I was shaking it a little. I was, like, moving it around. And I usually can see little bubbles coming up. I wanted to see if it was working. You know, I was getting kind of anxious. And it worked. And so you should always chill. If you're going to do, like, a carbonated beverage that's fermented, you should chill it before you open it. Because it'll always foam up. It's kind of like champagne. You should always chill it first.
Remember that.
I did not. And I was like, Chris, come around. We're going to open up this Lambrusco because he likes Lambrusco too. And it was one of those like pop top glass bottles. And I popped it and and the whole bottle just like turned into atoms. And it just, it sounded like a stick of dynamite went off and it was like, boom. And we were all covered in Lambrusco. I had like micro cuts on my face and my hands. Luckily, no one really got hurt. Chris Michelle, he didn't talk for a week. And long story short, you know, we've come a long way, but it made him buy safety glasses.
I do remember, I wasn't there for the explosion, but I came down a little while later and everyone was like, oh, whoa.
It was intense. It was intense.
You missed a thing.
Yeah.
And it's fine now. And everyone is like one of those.
But we
like,
learned. But we learned. And that's what's important, folks. But a couple other failures, you know, I tried making fish sauce once. And I had some sardines that were raw, and I kind of chopped them up. I added some aromatics and some water and salt, and I kind of like weighed them. And like the traditional way of making fish sauce, you just take fish and salt, weight, and it ferments, and the juice that comes out is fish sauce. But there's another way where you can kind of make like a liquid with a little bit of like a salt water, and then you let the fish ferment in it. And like, I was on the right page. I just didn't really know what I was doing yet. So it kind of looked like this like nasty gray chum. Mm. And it didn't work out. But, you know, I learned that I was just impatient. If I just let that go a little longer and ferment a little longer, it actually would start to clarify. It's not a quick process.
I feel like you made us taste that.
I don't think anyone tasted that.
There was something I had that there are certain experiments that you're like, hey, want to try? And it's like, yes.
Well, that's kind of my thing.
And then you kind of have to look and like, Andy will be like,
oh, people run. People run. Chris, Chris, oh, I start talking about breaking out spoons and Chris is up. He's gone. Hey, guys, you want to taste this? Boom, he's
and
gone.
And it's like,
boom, he's gone. But everyone's scared I'm going to get them sick, but it's hard to get people sick.
Yeah, I have not yet gotten sick.
Don't worry about it.
Talk a little bit about, you know, one of your favorite projects, and it's a little more recent, was the kraut.
Yeah.
Which was super successful
and
very delicious. And then are these things that are jumping from the test kitchen environment into the home? Like, what happens when you bring home like a couple quarts of kraut? How are the kids doing with that?
Well, the kids aren't quite there yet. I sneak it in for the younger one. He don't quite know yet, you know, and I kind of just blend it in.
He's more of the adventurous eater, right?
Well, they kind of, they go through phases.
They do, you
know? Like,
yeah.
They all, like, as babies, they're all like, yeah, like, they want to eat everything, you know. Under one, they just want to eat. But as he gets the one got a little older, he kind of...
He was like, I'm
started
good.
To form opinions. You know? But he'll come around, you know.
So you're having fermentation from at home, it's at work, kids are eating miso. fish sauce.
I mean, it's in everything, you know. It's just a layer of flavor. It's just that umami, you know. As long as it does, my 2.5-year-old want to eat a bowl of sauerkraut? No, you know. Do I? Yes. It's more, for me, like, the sauerkraut's a perfect example, and I think that's a great introduction for people who want to learn how to ferment and get into it, because it's super eager to, and it's a very easy process to do it, and it's very, you know, satisfying, because you can kind of eat it throughout. It's, you know, at first it starts a little crunchy, and then over time it gets, like, real mushy.
But you can eat it right away. But it's kind of like kimchi in that way. Exactly. You can have the fresh kimchi, you can have the fizzy kimchi.
Exactly, and I kind of like both. You know, I like it when it's fresh, but I also like it when it's big, when it's mushy. So it's, like, it's nice to be able to do this batch, and it's satisfying, you know? It's like, you made this, and, like, you come home, and you look at it, and it's bubbling away. Like, it's, like, you made that, you know? It's a thing. There's something to be said about making things, you know?
I agree.
Yeah.
Okay, so at one point you were making tapache. For people who don't know, explain what tapache is.
Yeah, another little carbonated beverage with pineapple. I was throwing some chili peppers in there, like a habanero, some ginger, a little brown sugar. It's a Mexican fermented beverage off of pineapple. I kind of deviated off it a little where I like to carbonate it as well, and you let that ferment, and then strain it, bottle it, do a secondary like you would kombucha. And it a nice little carbonation. And that was a hit, man. You know, like,
there
the
was a time you had those in bottles. Those were going. Yeah. Those went out a little bit.
Things happened
locally, but there was distribution going on.
People got their hands on them. And I wish we could pick that back up. But you know, it's the thing with fermentation is that it kind of, and it's kind of relative to cooking, like baking. Like you were saying with the turkey, like to the gentleman's question that he had, like, how long is it going to take? Well, that's a hell of a question. You know, like, it really depends. There's so many factors. Like, your oven might be hotter than mine. Your room might be warmer than mine, which would affect fermentation and time and how things go. So it's really, don't look for A, B, C, D. It's more, no, be connected to what you're doing and pay attention to what you're doing. And whether it be fermentation or cooking, you have to look at it. You know what I mean? And stop. And like my dad, my parents, they're both great cooks, but they tend to, what do I do next sometimes? And it's just like, you know the answer, you know? Like, so that, yeah.
Yeah. I feel like we write recipes or we show things. And the way I do it, it's going to be different when you do it. And the way that, and that's fine. And that's good. And also the way that someone who does it the fourth or fifth or sixth time on their own, that's when you really start cooking.
Yeah.
You know, like you're don't necessarily need the recipe anymore, but you've learned something to look for the next
thing. Exactly. And I mean, that's fermentation in a nutshell. It's kind of like you find your base guidelines and like your formats and your formulas that work. And then it's just kind of like, well, what do you want to do with that?
Right.
And it's, it is a form of cooking.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. It's, you're transforming something into something else.
And then you're eating it.
And then you're eating it or drinking it.
Yeah.
So what's next, Brad? So we're going to have like bottled tapache?
Nope. Nope, not at all.
Nope. And then do you feel like you're going to run out of, you're going to run out of things to ferment?
I mean, the struggle sometimes is that you know, they want to do videos that come out quick. People, you know, everyone wants to...
Quick. Every week sometimes.
Well, no, I mean, but the problem with fermentation is that sometimes it's not so quick. You
right.
know?
And We've got a couple-year-old miso hanging out.
Yeah, we had that one. It was the two-year swap there.
Yeah.
State record. So, I mean, it's fun to veer away from just doing straight fermentation. And, I mean, really my passion, I really enjoy, besides fermentation, is just going and telling how things are made, you know, like certain ingredients. You know, like chocolate, for example. Everyone, you know, except for Molly, everyone loves chocolate. But, like, you know, you go pick it up at your store, like, how the hell is it made? Like, coffee, how's it made? You know, like, I'm really into just going to the source of things. And we started to dabble that when It's Alive, and hopefully there's a lot more coming soon. We were just out in Italy, a little sneak peek. And we did olive
oil. It's tough sometimes, guys.
Tell you what, a lot of bad...
Those shoot days are long. We know.
Yeah, they are. And you know what I'm not doing is flying first class out there, okay? And like, so we go and we land. I'm very grateful, but it is work. And
sure.
I'm grateful for that, but I mean, you know.
Yeah, we're not going to stop making fun of you, but okay. I'm glad you're grateful.
Yeah.
Everybody gets that. Doesn't matter where you go. Right. Whoever you left behind is like, oh, it looks pretty nice out there. It's like, it was freezing cold. Yeah. I was standing in mud. Oh, okay.
Yeah. We took a red eye to cold rain. Yeah, okay, great, yeah. But, yeah.
So out in the world.
Out in the world.
Out in the world.
And just telling those stories, because, you know, besides me and the folks that we work with, you know, there's a lot of people out there doing really cool things that are involved with food or craftsmanship. And, you know, I do woodworking on the side a bit. And, like, I just like doing things. And being able to get involved with people and help show their stories, I really enjoy doing that.
Awesome.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and Christina Che, and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.